When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 187. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today we talk about Paul's trip to Saudi Arabia and the work he helped to do there. Let's get to it. Welcome to the show, everybody. We have a special guest today. No, it's not a guest. It's our old co-host, Paul. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing okay, though. As we know, I was away in the field for 2 months. I just listened to all of the episodes while I was away with Ed Gonzalez Tennant, and those were excellent. I mean, I really am a big fan of his and his work, and I really enjoyed those. So I wasn't really able to listen to any of the podcasts when I was away, so I've got like 50 hours of podcasts. Podcast that I'm trying to catch up on, but 25 when I listen to it double speed, right?
Nice. Well, we're actually spending a couple of weeks before we go to the Formula One race in Austin again this year, like we did last year. Mm-hmm. Spending a couple of weeks at a park we were at down outside of San Antonio, and that's not too far from where Ed is now located. He mentioned the San Rio something or other. I don't know. He's down closer to the border of Mexico. And not that San Antonio is that far away from there, but he said he's really close to where we're going to be. So might be able to hook up with Ed and see some of the stuff he's doing there. And also, just out of coincidence, we've interviewed people from, and I don't know if we have on this podcast, but I've interviewed people before from the American Veterans Archaeological Recovery, something or other. I can't remember. It's a team of American veterans that are doing archaeology basically on different things. And one of the projects they're doing, I just saw their newsletter come out, and they're going to be in basically, sounds like within about 5 or 10 minutes of where we're staying during the time that we're there. So I might be able to go out and interview them and see what kind of tech and things that they're using on their projects, especially with people who aren't necessarily trained as archaeologists. It'd be interesting to see their approach to things. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hoping all that works out during the time that we're there.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. That could be an interesting episode.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, we're going to talk about your trip over to Saudi Arabia and some of the methodology and things over there. But of course, for people who are not necessarily familiar with, say, the CRM Archaeology Podcast, anytime we talk about stuff on the CRM Archaeology Podcast, we never mention companies, we never mention clients, we never mention like specifics, because a lot of times there's contracts and things in place that are just, you know, they prohibit that sort of thing. And we like to honor that, right? So we're going to speak in a little more general terms, and that's really just being respectful of the people involved, because we're more interested in kind of what you did over, how you did what you did over there, not necessarily what you did or who you did it for.
This is going to be a little odd for me, because, you know, when I went away to Lagos last year, and this year I came back with stories to tell. We had those episodes that we recorded in the field, or the episode that we recorded in the field in Lagos. And there's really no prohibitions about what we're talking about, you know, on an academic project like that. I'm sure that certain academic projects, there would be things that are sensitive, especially around like human remains or, you know, things that might be considered treasures. But we didn't have to worry about that on those. This project, as you just said, it's actually a CRM project. I did not ask for permission to talk about it here, but so I'm going to have to be very circumspect.
Sure.
but I think I can do it, because there is still, you know, we used a fair amount of tech, and it's an interesting contrast for me having these different kinds of experiences since I got back into archaeology, into field archaeology, between the CRM projects I'm working on and the academic projects I've been working on, and can do a little compare and contrast maybe without divulging who I worked for or who they were working for, who they were hired by.
Right.
I wasn't going to mention Saudi, but then when I was listening to all those back episodes with Ed, we mentioned Saudi all the time. I was going to say a large Middle Eastern country, but I didn't even really want to go down and, you know, suss out what I was doing with whom. They could probably figure it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are certain sensitivities. I know, for example, we were asked to take photographs of people working in the field for the client of our own team. And bonus points if people had some of the company swag on them.
Right.
However, none of those photos, even though we've been taking these photos, and even though they know that the company I was working for wanted them and that the client would appreciate them, that over the course of like a month hasn't gone through channels and gotten the go ahead. So I knew that if I was going to ask for permission to speak in something less than generalities, we'd be waiting until December or something until I got that permission. So, I don't think we're going to upset anybody though.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. So, and like I said, that's not really our focus anyway. It doesn't matter the who, it just matters the how. That's what we're concerned with on this show. So let's set the stage. I just want to point out, I have to go back and review the tape, so to speak, but I'm pretty sure you mentioned you were going to Saudi Arabia before you even left, like on this show.
Yeah, I think I probably did. I'm pretty sure I did. I think I opened that door.
Right. So let's talk about just, so we can set the stage so people can understand like what the environment you were working in was like. We did that with Lagos too, but what was the... I mean, when I think of Saudi Arabia, I think of a huge freaking desert, which I don't think I'm too far off there. But what was the environment you were working in? And on top of that, what kind of archaeology were you doing? Survey, excavation, stuff like that?
Right. So the big desert is one of the things I always try to dissuade people of with their mental impression of what Arabia is. For background, I did my dissertation research in Yemen, which is down at the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. So I spent a lot of time in Arabia. I did also worked in Petra, which is in northern Arabia.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, big chunks of it are very desert. The entire area is, with the exception of a few spots in the mountains in Yemen, the entire area is very arid. So that part of your mental image is accurate, but it's not rolling sand dunes forever and ever.
Right.
There have been people living there since people have been people, you know, so a couple hundred thousand years. And people tend not to live in rolling sand dunes. They live in places where there's things like water and other resources around. So there's a long and deep historical and archaeological tradition of people living in such places. Predominantly mountains and coastal zones. So if you look at the Arabian Peninsula, you've got the Red Sea on one side, you've got the Arabian Sea on another side, you've got the Persian Gulf on the third side. It's bounded by water. A lot of people live on those coastal zones. And also, if you look at a topographic map, you'll see that particularly the west edge of the peninsula is very mountainous. And so we were in Western Saudi Arabia working in, yes, desert environments, very hot, very dry, you know, typically like 110 during the day, but 110 going up and down mountains, really craggy mountains the whole time. And yes, it was a survey. It was a survey and it was different kinds of survey. And maybe we'll get into a little bit of the detail of that. But fundamentally, we were working on a large development project. And so we wanted to find out, just like CRM in the US, we wanted to find out what potential archaeological resources would be impacted by that development project. So we had a big team and we were doing various kinds of survey. Some of us were tasked with going to sites that were already known, and we had a registry of about 1,000 different sites. And others were tasked with going over with some selected parcels of land and just walking transects to see what we could find.
Okay.
And yeah, so that was the bulk of the first half of what we were doing. There was those two different kinds of survey, and I participated in both.
Okay. It's interesting. You mentioned the Red Sea, Persian Gulf, the Arabian Sea. I've never been, well, I guess technically I've never been to Saudi Arabia, but I've been in all of those seas because I came through the Suez Canal on the Enterprise back in 96. And then we came down through the Red Sea and we went right around up into the Persian Gulf and did a stop in Dubai and a stop in, although we couldn't leave the fleet landing area in Dubai, there was a big issue. So we didn't get to see the cool stuff in Dubai. And then Jebel Ali, which I can't actually remember where that's at. It's in the UAE somewhere. So, but anyway, it was just such an interesting place and someplace I'd want to go back to again and visit for sure. But yeah, so crazy. So what was the last half of the time you're there like?
So the last half, well, we were still doing the existing site survey. We finished up the pedestrian survey of those parcels looking for new sites fairly early on, with the exception of a few that we had to get extra permissions for. And then we were just documenting previously recorded sites, plus, of course, any other sites that we'd find along the way. And the kinds of sites that we'd find, it was any time period, archaeological time period. So, for example, early on, we found a relic lake bed that had Levallois cores on it. That's pretty cool. You know, so very old.
That is
40,000
cool.
plus years old. Yeah. Other things were villages that were occupied into the 20th century, so Ottoman period villages, right? So anything in between. The majority of what we found were various kinds of, the dating is a little fuzzy, Neolithic or Bronze Age sites that were mostly either like rings of stones that were probably residences, very large rings of stones that were monuments of a kind, and cairns that were mostly burials. So, and a whole variety of different kinds of, different variants on all of these, how they were built, where exactly they were situated on the landscape, how many of them would be found in relationship to another, whether you'd find the like residential rings next to the cairns or in totally separate areas. You know, there was a lot of variability on that side, but we did see enough of these kinds of sites that we started pulling out different patterns, what we could expect in association with something else. And that was really fun. I mean, again, back to my, to my dissertation, I love working in Arabia and I'd kind of forgotten that. And I was brought on this project because of my knowledge of Arabian archaeology. And within, 15 minutes of getting out there the first day, it all started washing back. I'd forgotten. I hadn't used any of this stuff for 20 years. It all started coming back and it was so much fun to see this, and the variety of sites and the people that I worked with and the people that we met there, the locals. Mm-hmm. Just the whole suite of it was really enjoyable.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's take a short break and then we will come back and continue this discussion about your time over there in Saudi Arabia. We'll be back in a minute.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Archaeotech 187, and we are, we're talking with Paul on his experiences in Saudi Arabia the last couple of months, doing some work out there. So let's get into a little bit about, obviously this is the Archaeotech podcast, so let's talk about how you guys were doing things. And I want to take a short detour before that and just ask you, I guess really quick, what the recording methodology is over there. You know, I'm thinking like, Nevada uses the IMAX forms to record sites, California, the DPR. Does that area, or maybe, I don't know if there's provinces or states within Saudi Arabia, but do they have their own regimented, this is how we record archaeology sites in this area? Because I know actually some countries don't, right? It's kind of like the Wild West.
Yeah.
But some countries do, and they're very into their cultural history and have very specific ways to record it. So tell us a little bit about that, if you can.
Yeah, it was, to the extent I can talk about it, it was a little jarring to me. There isn't a formal format for how to record sites. And the registry that we had was kind of all over the board, both in terms of the terminology that was used and the detail that was provided to us of that roughly 1,000 pre-existing sites. Mm-hmm. I didn't always agree with what was called a site. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes I felt like, well, the site and the next two over are actually the same site. And sometimes I said, well, this site and the next site on the list, even though the list is two sites, yeah, they're really one site.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that happens all over the world.
Just the way things were split and lumped together. Yeah. Anyhow, so the Saudis really opened up. There was work done, archaeological work, particularly in the 70s and 80s, and then they were mostly closed to outside archaeologists until about 5 years ago. And so they are really trying to ramp up their expertise in the field of their own archaeology. And part of that is bringing in teams like the one I was on to work with them to try to improve their own data recording and reporting. And, you know, it's a work in progress.
Okay.
So we didn't have specific forms. We didn't have those IMAX forms, right? Or anything like it. What we did have was a fairly structured workflow from the company that I was with.
Yeah.
That dictated certain ways. And this was negotiated with the clients that they were hired by as to what things they thought were important.
Okay.
One little back point here is that the Department of Antiquities isn't a separate department. It's part of the Department of Tourism in Saudi.
Okay.
So a lot of what was being presented to us as to its importance wasn't necessarily its importance historically, archaeologically, in a way that you and I, Chris, might look at it, but its potential value for tourism.
Okay.
Which to me felt a little weird. It's certainly sensible. I can understand why they'd do that. But it did mean that some of the questions asked and some of the ways we did things were prioritized not the way I would have done it. Again,
sure.
Doesn't matter that it's not the way I would have done it. I don't think I've ever gone anywhere that is exactly the way I would have done it. And it's nice to learn a new way. But so we had this system in place. And early on in the project, when I was working on the parcels survey, and we would just walk transects, right? There was a super group of seven of us, I think. And we would just get out to the edge of one of the parcels and spread out and, walk our transects and see what we could see. Recording a new site if we found it, but very rarely did we find it doing that.
Yeah.
When we switched around a little bit and I got moved on to the existing site survey, the groups got broken up differently. And so it was myself and two other archaeologists. And the three of us formed a really good team. Basically, there were three things that we had to do. All our recording was being done on iPads.
Mm-hmm.
There was narrative and checkbox recording that was being done in a custom version of Codify. And I feel okay mentioning that here because Codify has shown up on ArchaeoTech many times. And working with Michael Ashley a bit. Many times.
Yeah.
Discussing things that could be improved or changed, having some questions about it, a little tech support here and there. But he came out to the project. And so, we were working with that as our primary, like I said, text and checkbox kind of recording interface.
Yeah.
We also have to take photographs, obviously. And the photographs we were taking with a program called Theodolite.
And
if you're not familiar with it. Yeah. So it's interesting in that it gives you the option of overlaying the notes that you take about a photograph directly onto the photograph. And so that means that you don't really have to have a separate photo log, right?
Right.
If you're facing northeast, it records what your direction you're facing. If you wrote down, this is a picture of an overview of the site facing northeast, it can print that directly on it. It'll save two copies of the photograph, the untouched one and the one with your notes overlaid upon it. So that's really handy.
Cool.
It is cool.
I don't think they used to do that.
I don't know. I've never used it before. I've heard about it before, but this was an integral part of the workflow that we had.
Nice.
And then the last thing that we had was obviously we had GIS.
Mm-hmm.
And so the program we were using is ICMT GIS, which is a little wonky. It feels like it's an old Windows 95 GIS that's been somehow ported to iOS. Nice. Certain things that you could not do without crashing it. But once we learned what buttons not to press and what things not to try, it worked really well for us. And the reason why we were using that was because it was recording locally. So as opposed to things like Field Notes, ArcGIS Field Notes, which has a cloud component, the client wanted us to keep all the data in country. So we had to go with something that recorded locally.
Okay. Okay. So that was my other question too, is you mentioned this GIS was ported over to iOS, which kind of brings me to the other question about equipment. Cause I know Codify has been on this show lots of times, actually, you know, back in the day when it was first getting off the ground. Michael's been on the show a number of times, and I know Codify was, and more than likely still is, based on FileMaker, which is an Apple program. And does that mean you guys were using like iPads out in the field? And then you also had this GIS on those iPads and you had Theodolite on the iPads as well, and you're just doing everything on one device? Is that what that is, that how that worked?
Well, we were doing it on three devices, the three of us on our team. So
One
was in charge of most of the narrative content, another one was in charge of most of the photographic content, and I was in charge of the GIS. And just like you've used before, and yes, these were GIS enabled, they're GPS enabled iPads.
Tablets,
Just like you've used before, we had external GPS receivers that we connected then to the GIS software so we could get higher accuracy than what would be available directly in the iPad's built-in GNSS receiver.
Right.
And so that generally worked really well. We were using a combination of SX Blues and Bad Elf Flexes. And, there were some issues with the Bad Elves in particular. There was also an issue that we had a whole bunch of external antenna cables that were a bad batch and they had the tendency to fall apart in the heat. So when it's 110 out, you don't want your antenna cables to just like melt and fall apart, but they sure did that.
Well, I feel like 110 is beyond the capabilities of a lot of things. I'm curious to see how the iPads handled 110.
You have to keep them out of the sun, right? You hold them so that the they have as little area exposed to the sun as possible. And what area is exposed is hopefully the backside of it, not the glass side of it, to keep them from overheating. I never had any trouble with mine overheating or running out of battery, but I know that the other people on my project, that happened to them fairly regularly.
If you're conscious of it, though, you can mitigate that. So, and you did a good job on that. Because I mean, you use tablets up here in Nevada too. I'm not in Nevada, but in Nevada on the projects we worked on, and I wouldn't say it was 110, but it was definitely higher altitude, so more UV exposure to the glass, and definitely not cool in some of those areas. So, a lot of the same strategies employed, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I've used the iPads very effectively without overheating, fortunately. At Lagos in Iraq. For me right now, the biggest ding I've got against using iPads in the field, and I wouldn't do without them because they're really integral to the way that I think about data collection at this point. But to me, the biggest ding against them is screen brightness, right? I'm working in parts of the world that have a really bright sun. You know, if we had that problem in Nevada, I've had that problem in Iraq, and I've had that problem in Saudi where you just can barely see what's on the screen because the sun is beating down too hard on it. You know, so you try to shade it with your body or find a corner that you can sit down or something, but you can't always do that.
The other big issue with all iOS devices to begin with, you know, so the iPhone and the iPad, is well before it overheats, well before it gives you the temperature overheat, it purposely dims the screen. So you can raise the screen brightness all you want, but it is purposely dimming that screen to prevent an overheating situation. And I think it probably uses a combination of not only temperature, but also actual brightness on the screen. You know, I've had times where it hasn't even been out for very long, like my phone or something that's sitting on a holder on the car or something like that. And you got sun going right on top of it. That screen will go to a certain level of dimness right away. And there's just simply nothing you can do about it unless you cool the device down. So, it gets frustrating for sure.
Yeah, that, like I said, that's my biggest ding against using this tech. It's going to get better because they've been getting brighter. And I know that especially in the drone space, there are certain tablets, I can't think of the brand name right now, but there's certain tablets that are made specifically for use outdoors, and they have extra brightness beyond, you know, your typical Android or iPad. Right. Yeah, so, you know, that it's a matter of a couple years, I think, before ones that are bright enough without overheating and such are going to be very common. I think we're just on the cusp of that. But at the moment, that was probably our biggest frustration. We had our truck was a Nissan Pathfinder. Pathfinder. Oh, I can't even remember right now. Anyhow, it had in the center console. Yeah, it's the Pathfinder. In the center console, it had a cooler.
Nice.
If we could get back to the car, we'd toss our iPads into the cooler in the center console. Nice. I mean, like air conditioned cooler, right?
Yeah. That's awesome.
So that was handy for us. Unfortunately, we did have to use it, and it would have been better if we didn't. But that's fine. It's what you deal with, right? You always have to be a little adaptive in the field, figure out what doesn't quite work the way you'd ideally like it to, and then how you work around that problem.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the tablets and the kind of field tablets, I would assume most of those are Android based only because, you know, obviously Apple doesn't let its software go on anything that's not an Apple tablet, and Apple refuses to use anything but glass on their tablets, which is beautiful and nice if you're sitting in a, you know, a coffee shop in or an office building in New York City. But if you're out in the desert working in the heat, the glass is your biggest detriment. So, you know, those ones that have a tendency to not overheat as quickly probably have plastic or some version of plastic screens on them, or at least covers over the computer screens. And that just helps, you know, that glass, man, does it just suck in the heat? And even in 70 degree weather, you can have, I've mentioned this lots of times and I've seen it happen before. You can have your device overheat and you're like, it's not even hot out. But if your glass is sitting straight onto the sun, that UV, not just the heat, but the UV will literally overheat your glass. And it doesn't have to be 100 degrees for that to happen. So, all right, well, let's take another break. And when we come back, we'll wrap up this discussion with Paul about his trip to Saudi Arabia. Back in a minute. Welcome back to Archaeotech 187. And we're wrapping up this discussion with Paul on his trip over to Saudi Arabia. So, Paul, we've talked about a little bit of the data collection. I am curious, because I don't think we've mentioned it before. Was there any sort of like just non-standard site recording stuff? And I love the fact that like recording with a tablet and software is essentially standard. But did you guys bring any other technology out there, any drone work, any GPR, anything like that on this phase of the project?
No, there's nothing like that in this phase. My understanding is there's going to be a fair amount of drone work in a future phase. Mm-hmm. It's all going to be conducted by Saudis. I looked into the rules of bringing my own drone to Saudi before I went there, but pretty sure I could have done it, but it was just enough paperwork and tests and such that I didn't have the time to do it. Right. I really wish I did have a drone because, like I said, very, very mountainous, very craggy. My boots, which are only a year old, are utterly, they look like I've just put them in a blender.
Just destroyed.
somehow they held together, but they look like I've gotten in a big fight lost. But so many times we're up on a ridge or in a saddle or, you know, God forbid, on a peak of something, and we want to see down around the edge. And the way that we had to do it was, you know, hoof it. And it would have been much better for me if I could just pop that drone out and fly it around, just take a quick look. Oh, yes, we do need to go 200 meters this direction because there's more stuff that way, as opposed to, you know, sending somebody scouting it. You know, fortunately, nobody got hurt. I'm really, you know, that was a great thing, is that it was kind of like an academic project. But everybody staffing is an experienced CRM professional. And so
nice.
A lot of the kind of silliness you'd get from having somebody too green in the field did not happen. Right.
Okay.
You just, That's awesome. People knew their physical limitations. They knew how to get around. They knew how to negotiate rough terrain, so on and so forth. And so, so things worked really, really professionally and efficiently that way. And that was fun. You know, when I got into field archaeology, I wanted to combine the CRM and the academic archaeology and, you know, pick and choose. And so this one was a very refreshing balance, partially, I think, because some of the principals on the project themselves are, came from academic backgrounds, and specifically academic backgrounds with experience in Arabia. So, you know, when I got to hang out with them and we could geek out on Arabian archaeology, that was a lot of fun. But yeah, all the CRM people I worked with were just no nonsense. They knew what to do.
And that actually does kind of speak towards some other things. Like Rachel and I recorded an episode, the last episode of Archaeotech, about field, like technology that can help you not only keep you efficient, but keep you safe in the field as well in some cases. And when you combine that kind of stuff with professionalism and just an understanding, and not only professionalism, but experience, things like the tragedy that happened with the young lady in Louisiana a couple of months ago, you know, it's just underlying health conditions notwithstanding, you can really work in any environment if you're well prepared for it. You know what I mean? Like if you know what you're getting into, you've hopefully been there before and you understand all the things that you need to do to actually be successful, and you do those things, more importantly, you stick to it, then I feel like you can really just work. You really could work anywhere in any environment. You just have to be prepared for it, you know? So, and you guys, I think, prove that.
Yeah. And I think another thing that's interesting too, to me, is that so many of the tools that we use, you know, I told you about these three particular programs, but a lot of the work that we did was, you know, trying to find how to get into places. So we were using Avenza, which we've talked about before. We were using Google Maps. We were using Google Earth, tools that weren't specific to working in Saudi, tools that we've all gotten comfortable using in the US and other parts of the world as well, just because that's what you use. Yeah.
Did you have online access in the field, or was everything downloaded?
Yeah, no, our internet access was weird. Where we were living was in a small town. It was a big crew. So some lived in a bigger city. I lived with the other half of the crew in a much smaller town, kind of in the middle of nowhere. We didn't have regular internet access. We all had SIM cards and would tether our equipment to that. Most of where I went, I had, you know, maybe a bar or two of 4G. Most of where I went, which was good enough to like, kind of download the latest whatever from Google Earth, but it wasn't guaranteed. And so there were plenty of times that we had to, you know, rely on whatever we'd preloaded in Avenza in order to find our way out to a site. And, you know, that worked. Again, it a lot of it just comes down to, you know, having a suite of different tools that you can use and pick and choose what's going to be best at the moment. And also, like I said about the archaeologist being experienced, having that experience. So we didn't have to like agonize over what tool should I use to find out how to get to my site. Here are three tools. I'm going to use the ones that are going to work right now because I've used them all before. Thank you very much.
You know? Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So that was good. But the internet access was an issue, particularly like the PDF reader that we had for that site registry updated itself. Well, needed to be updated twice when I was in the field and couldn't actually take the update because I was out of cell coverage. I used up huge, insane amounts of data on my cell plan. I kept on having to re-up it. And so that also wasn't perfect, but you know, again, nothing's ever perfect in the field, you know, just as long as it works well enough. Yeah, that's where we got to.
Okay. What about offloading data at the end of the day with those internet issues? Or did you guys send all the tablets back with the guys who were going into the city?
No. We definitely did the latter on occasion, but we weren't going into the city frequently enough. So we would offload the data. And so we had a workflow and server set up so that we could get the backup file from Codify, shape files out of the GIS uploaded to the site. The photographs that we took were backed up locally and, you know, onto hard drives. And then, and some of the photos were imported into Codify. And so became part of that, that Codify export. But, you know, there was a established workflow, established naming conventions where we had to put things. And The only trick that we had was that those Codify files, if they had photographs in them, could be pretty large. So we couldn't upload them from our living room where we preferred working. But the guy on the project on my team who was in charge of that would have to go back to his bedroom to upload from there, where he had a slightly stronger signal. You know, and it was a matter of, you know, taking 10 or 15 minutes to upload from his bedroom versus a couple, you know, hour or so from the living room. So that we just had to work around that. Again, not a killer. The other thing, actually, and I hadn't mentioned this, my plane ticket got messed up. So I ended up working into the next phase of the project. And the next phase, I only got to work on it a week, but it was really interesting because those GIS files in particular were then being taken into a GIS, a big computer that they had in the big city, and being processed there with some machine learning in order to help identify sites. So the last few things that we were doing was kind of like the pre-registered sites, the pre-recorded sites and visiting them, except for this was going to places that had high likelihood of being sites.
Okay.
And so we would go there and record either the presence or the absence of sites that the computer had spat out at us. So that was exciting to be part of that project. And that's part of the whole thing that had been sold to the client, the development of this system. And you know, so I got to work on it, on the data collection, the initial data collection, but then also some of the ground proofing afterwards. So that was a lot of fun for me, just because I do think that this is an important way forward. Allowing, as we have better and better access to satellite and aerial imagery of various kinds, allowing the computers to do some of the predictive work that before it would be done by, you know, by archaeologists poring over photographs. Now I let the computer chug away and do that, and then spit back, you know, here are some likely sites for you.
Nice. That is kind of the dream, isn't it? That's awesome. I love it. All right. So anything else that we didn't really get to that you think you should mention about this project?
No, there are going to be more phases of it, provided that the client continues to be happy with the work that was done. I'm hoping that I don't get anybody in trouble, especially myself, for what I've said right now, but I think it's vague enough. But it also, in some ways, I feel like I got a little bit of a glimpse of the future of how a big project like this will be carried out. You know, it was born digital. It was digital processing. It was a collaborative effort between a lot of different field specialists, right? Not shovel bums, not field techs, but people who, even if their official title was field tech, were so experienced that they were excellent at it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, an academic component and tourism component and, you know, a preservation component, all these different things converging. Yeah, it was a good project. I was really glad to be part of it. And I'm hoping that I continue to be part of it.
Nice. Nice. Well, that's great. So it was awesome hearing about those experiences. And I don't know what we're talking about next time, but I'm sure it will be fascinating. So it's good to have you back, Paul. Before we close out this episode, I need to mention that over on our member Slack channel for Archaeotech, if you're not a member of the APN, go to archpodnet.com/members and you can check it out. We've had a few new members just today. And Walter Upperman, who was on this show talking about archaeology in Flanders, which I always forget is like a region of Belgium, right? He liked our episode that Rachel and I did on different applications and things like that for field archaeology and gear and stuff like that. And he has his own list of things that we didn't mention that are over in the Slack channel. So I'll have you, if you're a member, go check that out because he's got some good stuff over there. If you're not a member, then please, archpodnet.com/members, and you help us out. It's only $7.99 a month. Or you can get 25% off by going through for the whole year, just like Jordan and a few others did today. They got the annual membership. Yay. So we really appreciate that. I know, right? So we love it when we can bring more people in. And you know, honestly, not only does that keep the lights on, but I mean, I just love having and seeing these conversations take place amongst members in the Slack channel, right? And that's kind of why I wanted to start this whole network, was to generate conversation and get people talking about this stuff. So I'm glad to see it's happening over there. All right. Well, with that, I think we will sign off this week, and we'll be back, like I said, in 2 weeks with another great episode. Thanks again, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Glad to be back. Glad to talk to you again. And we're going to have some, I've seen a few articles while I was away, didn't get to read them because, you know, that internet issue. Right. Yeah, I think that there's going to be some good content coming up.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off-Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.